Today, the climate crisis, flooding, and a Welsh village that could be abandoned to the sea. And Lily Kuo on the siege of Hong Kong's Polytechnic University.
Would everything that we can see now, would that all go underwater?
Yeah, it's everything to the seaside of the railway. Everything you can see now, and it would be the roadway.
So stretching up to the road, right over beyond those trees.
Yeah. That's where the tide will come to, if and when this ever happens.
The if and when they're talking about is rising sea levels threatening a village on the northwest coast of Wales. That has led to an unprecedented decision. In 2045, less than 30 years from now, flood defences will no longer be funded in Fairbourne and all its residents will be moved out. Some say that will make them Britain's first climate refugees.
The Welsh seaside town of Fairbourne is a beautiful but low-lying town on the end of an estuary in Wales. And slowly but surely, the water is rising.
But flooding is not just a risk to coastal communities. Last week, heavy rain burst the banks of rivers across parts of England, causing devastating damage and making the environment a key election issue. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus. With widespread flooding and a village being abandoned to the sea, why aren't politicians saying more about the climate crisis? Rachel Humphreys, you're a presenter and producer at Today in Focus. Tell me why you went to Fairbourne.
Tom Wall, a journalist who writes for The Guardian, went there in May and wrote a story about it. It's a little village on the northwest coast, and it's the first place in the UK that is being abandoned because of rising sea levels. In 2013, it was decided by the local council and Natural Resources Wales, which is their version of the Environment Agency, that the village would be decommissioned. So that means it would be dismantled. They would stop funding the flood defences and the village would just go back to being salt marshes.
What's the village like?
It's small. Around 800 people live there, and I think there's about 400 or so houses, mostly bungalows. It's sandwiched between the edge of Snowdonia National Park and the sea. And when I arrived there back in the summer, it just really struck me how beautiful this place is. And you can go down to the seafront. It's got this long, stony beach. And when I got there, it was the morning. It was high tide and the waves were sort of pulling up onto the beach and then kind of lazily rolling back and pulling all these rocks with them. Its beautiful location is also its problem. It's got an estuary on one side of it and then it's got the sea. It's got two rivers running through it. And of course, when rain comes down off the mountains, that has to go somewhere. And if you look down the seafront, there's a row of bungalows that run all the way down, have a beautiful view, but they're lower than the sea. And when that sea surges, you can just understand how it would come over and affect some of those homes. The longer you spend there, you can kind of get the sense of what a lot of residents tell me, which is this place feels like their kind of corner of heaven.
Welcome to our part of paradise.
The first person I met was Stuart Eaves. He's kind of like the chief of the village. He's the spokesperson, yeah. He is. He's on the local council and he is the kind of spokesperson for Fairbourne on this issue of it being abandoned.
And it's the only village throughout the country where any council has gone to anybody and said this, and it's all been mishandled.
Fairbourne attracts a lot of tourists. You know, they obviously come for the beach, but they also come for the steam railway. And then there's an arcade, there's a fish and chip shop. I was given a tour from Connor.
Oh,
it's loud, that thing, isn't it?
Yeah, you hear it all over the village.
He's 16 and he's lived in and around Fairbourne for years and was really keen to tell me about the village.
So this is Kath's post office, as Kath is there carrying the crate. And she's just gone into the cafe where me and my granny, we usually start our day with a nice coffee and a sausage roll.
And it just reminded me that in communities like Fairbourne, it's very close-knit. You know, wherever we went, Connor would say, oh, that person is related to this person.
Do you know why, sorry, Connor, to interrupt you, there's a suit of knight armour in that house?
That's my friend's nan's parents. They are in love with their history, I think.
And one of the people we bumped into on that walk was Glyn. Glyn's lived in Fairbourne for 10 years.
There's a life here and it's all quite positive, to be honest with you.
And yeah, really, he's good. Got a great sense of humour. He works in a bar and is a drummer in a local band.
Our singer has cerebral palsy and they said that he wouldn't live past a certain age and that he would have to be in a wheelchair. Well, he's 36 and he's still singing and he's amazing, really. So we will continue for as long as is possible.
There was a real sense with Glyn, and I felt this was quite important in the context of why I was in Fairbourne, that he is a person who, he lives for today, that's what he told me. And that's an attitude he doesn't just have when it comes to the singer and his band. That's also how he thinks about Fairbourne and it being decommissioned.
So I don't see the point in worrying overly about what might or might not happen in 40 years' time. Yeah, we know the sea level's rising, that's a fact. But, you know, how they deal with these things can change on a daily basis, depending on who's in government, who's in local government, and any action groups, really, that may spring up.
And that's the way a lot of people in Fairbourne, I think, see it like that.
What, that it will never happen?
Not that it will never happen, but that you can't spend your life worrying about it happening.
Are people worried, then, about the thought that the village will be demolished in the next 30 or 40 years, or does that still feel like a long way off?
There are a lot of people in the village who are worried, like Connor's granddad, Dennis. I met him at the end of my tour with Connor and he's in a wheelchair.
I've only been in the chair 5 years.
And he's lived in Fairbourne for a very long time. And for him, moving out just isn't feasible.
We had thought when the scaremongering started where to go and live, but everywhere in the vicinity have all got steep hills or very long hills, and there is nowhere that I can actually say I can feel comfortable, not like I do in the village.
But a lot of people are really angry, like Stuart, who feels that the decision made 6 years ago was done without enough planning or evidence.
How can you put a time limit on something you don't know what's going to happen? If they would just come and said, OK, there is going to be a problem in the future, we don't know when, we're monitoring the sea level rise, and if it comes to a critical condition, then we will come and talk to you and make our decisions. That's fine. The house prices stay the same, people can buy and sell their houses. But to come and say, we are going to decommission you in 2045... So now you can't get a mortgage.
And that's another issue. The decision to, as Stuart says, call time on Fairbourne means that it's become really hard to get a mortgage here. Although a lot of people told me that this has changed in the past few months and some people have been able to buy and sell again.
I mean, you said the word decommissioned, which is the word that they use. I noticed you raised your hands and gave us some parentheses because it's a really weird dehumanising word, isn't it? I mean, you decommission a robot or a factory. You don't decommission people.
Yeah, and this was something that a lot of people I met said to me. It feels really callous. It feels coarse. It makes them feel like they are just, it's just part of a procedure which is going to have to happen.
It feels like Fairbourne is a very unique place, but also like lots of other coastal towns around the UK. Why aren't they prepared to defend it?
There is a specific geographical reason that Fairbourne is, you know, particularly vulnerable because of its position by the sea, next to the estuary, and built on salt marshes. And Natural Resources Wales have been obviously funding flood defences here for quite some time. You know, about 4 years ago, they completed a 6.8 million flood defence scheme. But they say that it's not viable to keep defending Fairbourne, that actually with projected water level rises and the chances of sea surges, it would just be too much to keep holding the line.
But Fairbourne is the one place in the whole country that has been picked out. I mean, does it flood regularly?
According to the residents, no. I mean, when I was speaking to Stuart, we were stood up in his garden. This was something that he said.
So in the over 30 years that you've been here, how many times has Fairbourne flooded?
Never. Absolutely never. It's laughable because, as I say, they keep pointing the finger, Fairbourne's going to flood. You get a storm and you look at the news and they've been underwater and that's been underwater and Fairbourne's got nothing again.
But actually, it's not necessarily about the actual flooding that's happening. It's more about the potential flooding that could happen and potential sea and tidal surges.
How much is the sea predicted to rise?
In the initial management plan, the Environment Agency said it would be 0.5 metres within the next 50 years. And then in the next century, it could be by a metre.
And you mentioned the report. Who actually decides that a place can be decommissioned? How was that decision made?
Well, this is the very difficult issue. I mean, ultimately, it does come from the Environment Agency, who sort of estimate how long they can fund it for and how much within their budget they're going to be able to fund it for. But this is something that I spoke about with the Plaid Cymru MP, now the Plaid Cymru candidate for the area, Liz Saville Roberts.
Well, exactly. And there is no regulation, there's no statutory requirement on somebody to make that call. And you have that mix of social housing, but mostly private housing, which people do own. So you have a whole question of duty of care alongside who is presently responsible for their private property.
This will need to be decided by a range of public bodies, not just Natural Resources Wales and Gwynedd Council, but also the Welsh Government. The decision comes down to those who are paying to defend it. But within that, there hasn't been a process to look at how people will be rehomed, reimbursed, or how there will be a safety net put in place for those people after it happens.
What do we know about the planning?
I've had a look at some of the plans, and there's still a lot that's outstanding. So if you look at the resettlement plan, where residents will be relocated, it still says funding required. And if you look at their work in investigating where people could be moved to, which houses they could live in, it still says there's currently no funding available.
And what do the local council say about this?
They say it's a very sensitive issue. They describe it as an unprecedented situation. And they say there are many difficult questions that they need to work together to answer, but that they need to persuade the Welsh and the UK government to recognise that there's a need for new policies, additional funding, and to support Fairbourne, but also other communities that this is going to happen to and could soon face the same kind of consequence.
Fairbourne is by no means the only place in Britain that is being threatened by the climate crisis. Sandra Laville is an environment correspondent for The Guardian. Sandra, is flooding the biggest climate threat to the UK right now?
Yes, and it will be for decades to come. And I think if you look across the globe, you see Australia on fire at the moment, and that's going to be their issue, and our issue is going to be flooding. So this is going to happen more and more.
Is it already happening much more?
Yes, it's happening more and more. We've seen it last week in Yorkshire and the north.
In Doncaster, the local river spilled over, flooding properties with little warning. People grabbed what they could.
And it's a huge issue, obviously, for coastal communities, some of whom will actually have to physically move.
And that's what's happening for the people in Fairbourne. They're facing something unimaginable, the fact that they may in the future have to abandon their homes to the sea. What you're saying suggests they're not the only community that this could happen to.
No, indeed, they're not. And the latest report from the Environment Agency, a very stark warning earlier this year, was that we're going to have to accept that we can't keep building walls against water. And we're going to have to abandon some communities in the UK.
It will, over the long term, simply not be possible to protect some of those places against either flooding or coastal erosion. And in those circumstances, the best solution is likely to be to move the people out of harm's way.
What is the Environment Agency's approach to tackling increased flooding across the UK?
Well, I think the Environment Agency is very honest that it can't stop flooding. It can't stop all flooding. And their approach is a kind of joint approach of we do need physical barriers, and they're trying to upgrade physical barriers, but also they say we also need natural barriers and flood relief systems, so we need a combination. So in the Netherlands they use sand dunes in certain communities to stop having to build ever higher flood and sea walls. But I mean, the key point the Environment Agency are saying, and I think they're saying it very loudly as a kind of kick to government, is that we can't do this all the time. There are communities we won't be able to protect, and that we do have to become as a country more resilient, and people have to become more resilient. So when you look at developing countries and you see global events happening to them, and we kind of sit back in our armchairs to a certain extent and think, oh God, thank God it's not happening to us. Well, it is going to be happening to us. So we are going to have to start building homes that are much more resilient to flooding.
Is it also about not building in flood-prone areas? There was a story last week about 10,000 new homes that could be built on some of the most flood-prone areas of England. It came from a Greenpeace investigation. I mean, what is the incentive to be building in places like that?
Well, I think the key pinch point is that we have all these political parties promising to build significant amounts of houses, and we have a housing crisis in this country, and we live on an island which is threatened by floods. And what Greenpeace did is they looked at, took a sample of planning applications, and they laid over it a map of floodplain areas at high risk of flooding, and they matched in a lot of areas. So obviously many of these planning applications to meet the housing crisis are going to be in floodplains, and the Environment Agency is able to object to these, but it's not a binding objection. The plans can still go ahead.
And presumably, if you choose to live in those areas, you've got a whole load of other factors that you're going to have to deal with, including increased insurance.
Yeah, and also not able to get insurance, inability to get. I mean, I think that is one of the key things that's going to happen, is that you won't be able to get insurance in those areas.
The news in the last 40 minutes or so that my insurance company have excluded flood from my policy.
Right. No, that wasn't what you were expecting.
No. So I feel really selfish in saying this, and I hope that other people in this village aren't in this boat. But I've lost my home and my business and my livelihood that I've worked so hard.
I mean, that Greenpeace investigation included hundreds of new builds in areas including Doncaster, which was badly hit this month by flooding. I mean, we've seen plenty of politicians visiting residents in the worst hit areas.
Why has it took you so long, 5 days, Boris, to come and see us here? What's the answer, please?
The answer is that people have been working around the clock to address the problems here in Spain.
But have you heard anything from those politicians that suggests they're taking this seriously?
Well, no. I mean, I think the thing is, I don't think they project, if they are taking it seriously, they don't project the sort of catastrophic nature of this in this country in the coming decades. And, you know, the government currently is putting £2.6 billion of public money in up to 2021 from 2015. And all of the evidence and all of the suggestions is that's just not enough. And the National Infrastructure Committee, which is in charge of going through the country, looking at our seawalls, our dams, our barriers, just says these barriers date back to the Victorian times in many cases and would need to be upgraded. And they've called for £1 billion of investment per year until 2065. Now, that's not actually that much money. It just needs political commitment. And I don't think that politicians are taking this seriously enough.
I mean, the very fact that we had flooding last week in the north has meant that this has become an issue at the centre of this election. In terms of the different parties and their environmental policies, what are they planning to do?
So I think, yeah, the flooding has thrown the environment and climate change very much centre stage, and the images of Boris Johnson being heckled as he visited Yorkshire, the residents would say very belatedly, have really put that on the front pages. Now, the parties are all making pledges on the environment, from billions of pounds to tackle climate change to announcements on flooding. I don't think the Conservative Party has made any announcement regarding flooding money at the moment. But yeah, the Labour has got their Green Industrial Revolution. The Liberal Democrats have announced policies on climate change last week. And actually, it's many experts were saying to me, it's the first time for a very long time that climate change and the environment is on the election agenda. And that is probably down to the devastating flooding.
We've got an election in just a few weeks' time. Is this issue in Fairbourne going to affect how people vote there? Is this a very safe Plaid Cymru seat?
It's very much a Plaid seat. It's always been Plaid. And Liv Saville-Roberts, who was the local MP and now the Plaid candidate, has had a strong majority. And the thing about Fairbourne is that it's a village where it's mostly English people living there, but it's in a very Welsh area. It's in a predominantly Welsh-speaking area. And so Plaid are standing up for the people of Wales. That's why Plaid do so well in that seat. But I did call a few of the Fairbourne residents last week just to talk to them about their voting intentions. And it was clear that a lot of people are going to be thinking about the promises that are being made to them by local candidates, and that will inform their decision when it comes to voting on December the 12th. Glyn said that he's probably going to vote for Plaid, and he feels that they stand up for him, and he thinks that the local MP there has been pretty good at speaking up for Fairbourne.
Do they run the council?
Yeah, it's a Plaid-run council. That's an issue for some people there who don't think the council have done a great job with regards to Fairbourne, so that might affect how they vote. And that's certainly the case for Stuart, who said that he is going to be voting Labour at this election because the Labour candidate is a local man who has made it a priority to talk to residents in Fairbourne about what's happening there.
I can't imagine what it must be like for people living in Fairbourne and other communities to know that in your lifetime, your home might be abandoned to the elements.
Yeah, and I think that what I came away thinking about from Fairbourne, and certainly what I've been thinking about when reading about communities that have been flooded in recent weeks, is that so often this is happening to places that are already quite cut off and have already been affected by austerity, perhaps more than certain parts of the country. This is going to be a huge problem for them. It's not something any of them could ever have predicted could have happened. And, you know, this is what the MP Liz Saville-Roberts said to me, that this is not just, we can't just look at this as an environmental issue now, it's a social issue too.
Rachel, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anushka.
That was Rachel Humphreys. Our thanks to Tom Wall for all his help. Do read his article about Fairbourne at theguardian.com. Yesterday, the Green Party was the first to launch its manifesto. Do read our coverage of that and of the other parties' policies as they're released. Coming up, Lily Kuo on the latest explosive chapter in the Hong Kong protests. Now, this week, Hong Kong has seen hundreds of protesters resisting police attempts to take control of Polytechnic University. The university was originally seized 11 days ago to facilitate the blocking of the Cross Harbour Tunnel, a major access point for the city. As the siege wore on Tuesday night Hong Kong time, we spoke to The Guardian's Beijing bureau chief, Lily Kuo.
Polytechnic has been occupied actually since last Sunday. The protesters were seen clashing with some residents who were trying to clear barricades that and roadblocks that the protesters had put up, which then blocks the tunnel. And then the riot police came out and started firing on the protesters, firing tear gas, and then that kind of lasted all of Sunday. And then by Sunday night, there was basically a lockdown on the university and all the exits were blocked. And so it's basically from Sunday night until now that that this sort of, what some people are calling a siege, has been going on. So there was one front line, which was kind of just right at the entrance to the university. You had riot police, you had a water cannon, and then you had a line of protesters on the ground. And then above them, from within the campus, was a roof that protesters had set up, or they were sort of, don't know if you call it providing cover for the people on the ground, but they were shooting the Molotov cocktails. Sometimes some people were using these catapults. Some people were seen shooting bows and arrows. You could still get in on Sunday in the afternoon. And I mean, it looked like a kind of the behind the front lines of a battle. We haven't been able to get back into the university since then. So we've been able to talk to some protesters inside just by calling people. And the atmosphere sounds totally different. I mean, there are fewer people there now because we've had kind of waves come out. And one protester that I talked to on Monday said that they were all scattered across the campus and everybody was hiding in different buildings, hiding in offices and barricading themselves in because they thought the police would storm in at any time and they were just trying to hide. It's not so much about the university, holding on to the university or this tunnel or whatever. People just want to protect these protesters, many of them young, many of them students, who people feel are under attack by the police. Throughout the protests, which started off about this extradition bill, which we know has now been withdrawn, a lot of people actually, what motivates them is what they think is police brutality against these protesters who they are using Molotov cocktails and recently bows and arrows, but people think that the police, you know, they have tear gas and armored vehicles and rubber bullets. So they think that the force that the police are using on the protesters is uncalled for. And so that's really what this is about. Over this whole thing, over the last almost 6 months, the possibility of the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, being deployed to put down the demonstrations has sort of hung over everything. And obviously the memories of the Tiananmen crackdown in 1989, which people in Hong Kong know and remember very well. But the last week, things have really escalated. The PLA came out for this very innocent exercise of, you know, helping residents clean up the streets. But this is only the second time they've come out in 22 years. And that also came after Xi Jinping spoke about the crisis for the first time, saying that order must be restored. So things are kind of moving in a way that people are more concerned, even though, you know, there's no sign that there's going to be a crackdown tomorrow, but people are worried. Once they come out, I don't think it will be over, because as long as people feel like the government isn't listening to them, I think they're going to keep coming out.
That was Lily Kuo. Do keep up with her brilliant coverage on this. That's it for today. My thanks to Lily, to all the people who we spoke to in Fairbourne, and to Rachel Humphreys, who also produced this episode, along with Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.